Is this thing on?
All right.
Hey, it's Brock, and welcome to the Sprocket Podcast. Just wanted to give you a little bit of extra audio this week. We are super excited about Joe Beal's documentary, Aftermass, and this is coming out very, very soon. The premiere showing of the film is going to be at the Clinton Street Theater here in Portland, Oregon, and that is 7 p.m. on May 23rd, 2014. So close. Tickets are $7, so definitely want to have you go there if you can, if you're in the Portland area or nearby. And if you're not, you can go to microcosmpublishing.com/aftermass to find out where you can see it or get a copy of it sometime in your area. So anyways, without a lot of further ado, let's go to this conversation that I taped with Joe Beal at Microcosm Publishing in North Portland. I started by introducing myself or reintroducing myself to Joe's dog, Ruby.
Does this go live to the internet?
This does not go directly to the internet, no. I put it on this thing, and then it goes from this thing to another thing, and then it goes to the collection of things. So, yeah. Ruby, I met you at the World Without Cars ride.
No. Oh, yeah, that's right. Well, way back.
Yeah.
A year ago, maybe more.
That was, well, it was last year's Pedalpalooza, and that was the year that I think, well, I've only been on that ride the one time. I don't know if it's happened more than once, but I think you were kind of at the end of the group, and LA went back to find you, and then the rest of the group cruised on downhill, and then we couldn't, we never found, like, you know, quorum again. We were all going to, like, find a breakfast place, but it was okay because nothing's open. Like,
really?
Anywhere. I'm trying to remember when we were done. Sunrise was probably like 5 o'clock or something.
Yeah, I remember.
Or maybe 5:30.
And I looked and I just went home.
Yeah.
I never even. And then Ellie found me at home after she had looked for me elsewhere, you know? I'm like, oh, whatever.
Yeah.
Sometimes how it goes.
Totally. No, we tried to find, like, I don't know, 6 different spots. Like, we went to the Stumptown over on Belmont, and we went down to the Cricket Cafe. And even Tom's on Division and 39th.
Mm-hmm. Nothing?
Nothing was open. Yeah, the very earliest would have been like 6:30. And there was nothing. Absolutely. So really, it all worked out for the best, I think. So, yeah. Anyways, hello, Ruby. Good to see you again.
Ruby is definitely... She's since been certified. She's in the top 10% of her class. She is.
Oh, really?
Very...
As a helper dog?
Mm-hmm.
Is that the technical term?
Or medical alert. Well, medical technically alert. He's a service dog. And
yes.
Of service dogs, she is a medical alert service dog.
There we go.
And then from there, it's like... Oh.
Right.
But that's, that's its own learning thing. But, yeah, it's like, of all the things that have federal protections, these guys,
mm-hmm.
It's like you can barely ask about them.
Yeah.
Even like,
excuse me,
right? Even in Fred Meyer, like the most they can ask is, "What service does the dog perform?" And from there, their hands are tied.
Yes.
Unless the dog like shits on the floor, or, like barks, or you know.
Right, and then all of a sudden you've got an issue because then there's health codes and that sort of thing. But
yeah.
But she can kind of hang out anywhere she wants to. She's a super dog with a cape.
Right. Yeah.
It's more of a hoodie, I guess. Right.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's so. Yeah, we go on Amtrak tomorrow, and
oh yeah,
they can barely
right.
You know, and the way that with them, you obviously do it in advance because
they
don't want the mess of you showing up and them having to vet you.
Well, you'll probably do better with a service dog than with folding bikes, I would guess.
Well, she was with us when we had the debacle.
So if you had the dog and the bike in the same place.
Oh, yeah, that might be the protection. Yeah, she was... We were asleep, though.
Oh,
so
right.
I just left her in bed because, you know, she doesn't...
Yeah.
I mean, then it's just, like, sad when we all come out, like, bedraggled.
Right.
But, they didn't say a damn thing about her, even when they did see her. But that, it was weird.
Yeah. And I've heard Ellie's side of the story from, like, everywhere because it was well-publicized on the internet. But what was that like for you?
Oh, it was horrible.
Okay.
I mean, it was just, you know... I mean, it was horrible, but at the same time, it's like Amtrak has been my full go-to national transportation for over 12 years.
Yeah.
And so I sort of, it's like the level of service that you get.
Mm-hmm.
And then, and I've always been, you know, like, Ellie is helping me take this to a sort of less accepting, more they should actually follow their own rules kind of stance rather than just be like, well, whatever, this is how it is.
Right, and internal consistency, at least, is that's like the very bare minimum of what you should expect.
Yeah, exactly.
That makes sense, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah. And, well?
But that's, you know, it's not... Whatever, how they wanted to do business, and it is no longer how they... I mean, so this is the thing. Even on that trip, no less than 6 different times were staff members telling me that I was not allowed to have my bike in places where I was... You know, I used to carry around the printout from their website, because I thought that would solve the problem, and it doesn't.
Right.
They just tell you that it doesn't apply in this situation, or what, you know, or whatever. And that, you know, and definitely times they were like, it's been this bad before... But, you know, it's funny where, like, on one trip, no less than 6 different employees in different cities are like, oh, you can't have that.
Yeah, so it's not just Texas, then.
Oh, no. Oh,
it's
no.
System-wide.
It's America.
Yeah.
And, but then, you know, and since that trip, obviously that helps. Because now when they come up and they're like, oh, I'm sorry, you have to put that in a box. I'll be like, oh, no, it's a folding bike. And now instead of arguing with me, they say,
oh...
Right. Yeah, they're just like, oh, gotcha, right. I remember that memo. I received that on my desk.
So the Sisyphean stone has been rolled over the lip of the hill,
mm-hmm.
and Sisyphus is free to travel with mm-hmm. his bike on Amtrak.
Right, and now rather than, like, misquoting their own rules, they say, oh, those things are such a pain in the ass for us.
Right.
And that's the honesty. That's
they can
better.
Say that.
Right,
yeah. Makes sense.
Yeah, exactly. And then it's funnier, though, when the train is... Like, the compartment is empty.
Right.
And they're still complaining about it.
Right.
Because you're like, what happened? Or they'll... And actually, I was just in... Well, actually, not with Tim this time, but with our sales guy. We were just in Chicago last week, and it was the same way. They refuse... So they have, you know, the check where you can, like, hand them your luggage and then go eat lunch and come back.
Oh, right.
And they say, oh, we can take your luggage, but we cannot accept that folding bike.
So they know where the lines are drawn then, isn't it?
But that's a very broad misinterpretation of even their own rules.
Sure.
Know? Like, it may be technically plausible, but that's, you know.
Right.
Well, ten years ago, probably, they literally bought me I had a connection in Chicago, and they bought me a Greyhound ticket.
Oh.
Because they did not want to deal with my bike on that train.
Like, just put it, was it in a box and everything, or?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah, but they just... Wow.
It was worth it to them to buy me that ticket.
It never ceases to amaze me how little Amtrak wants to deal with bicycle. Like, it's the perfect pairing, and yet it is the worst situation.
Mm-hmm.
It could be so good. The potential is there, and yet... Yeah. Do you have plans for National Train Day?
National Train... I think we are on the train on National Train Day.
So oh, there you
my
go.
Plan, which is, this has happened more than once by just dumb coincidence. Or not great coincidence.
Sure.
Fabulous coincidence.
Happy luck.
What better way to spend that day? You can pretend like it was planned all along. But yeah, I think we are on our way to New York then.
Excellent.
So that's, which is like the perfect way to have it, you know, cascading days,
yeah.
for, you know,
yeah.
all day on the train.
Right. And so is this with Aftermath then? Are you doing the tour for the film on train?
We have some of it. Because it's the big problem is like the best place to go on tour is the smallest towns. And there are many cities with populations approaching a million that
mm-hmm.
have no train service.
Yeah.
And this was the goal 4 years ago, was to do the whole thing on trains. But we've gotten it down basically where we can do California on trains, no problem.
California's good.
Yeah, yeah. And then, I mean, but still, you have to cut out a lot of the state.
Yeah.
Because you just can't go places. And
yeah, Modesto, for example.
Right, right.
Actually, Modesto might have, I mean, I don't know.
Right.
It's bad. I don't think about that place much. I'm sure it's beautiful.
So what you run into is like Nashville. Huge,
yeah.
Huge city, no mm-hmm. train service. You know?
Right.
Places like that where you're like, oh, this would be the perfect outlet. And, you know, or when we mapped out a tour 1 year, Ellie and I did, would have been 4 years ago or so, and that was the real problem was we were like, okay, well, if we cut out all, you know, it's like you can either go to places that have train service, you can go to places where you have promoters, you know.
Right.
They're like...
But never the twain shall meet.
Right, right, yeah, exactly. And so we kind of gave that one up.
Yeah.
But yeah, we have, and we got, and this is the other funny thing is we got the Bromptons explicitly for the purpose of being able to bring them on Amtrak.
Yes.
I mean, they're great commuters and fun and all that, but the whole point was that so we could go on tour and bring the Bromptons and, like, have the, you know, we have luggage that the gear packs into, so the whole thing works, and that's what we're doing tomorrow, but, you know, I mean, it's... And then you run into Amtrak staff.
So many extra steps. Yeah. Have you ever thought about just getting one of those old, like, hard-sided suitcases and then, like, turning it into a trailer?
I have, yes.
Because then you could fly under the radar.
Right.
But yeah. If they see, like, a spoke or a cog, you know, the teeth on a freewheel, you're in trouble.
It seems like now you just have to have, like, two unpleasant conversations and, like, hold your ground.
Right.
You know, and that's...
And then they're like, okay, all right, fine. We'll bring you the cheeseburger or
whatever. Yeah. And that's, yeah.
Yeah. One thing that's very exciting, last time I was down in California was for spring break, and the Coast Starlight used to have this arcade car.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, it still does.
That's probably the one you think, maybe, I don't know if that was what you were referencing earlier or not, but they are looking into converting that into some sort of, like, storable space, because no one plays the video games they bought for it, because the video games they bought for it are 20 years old, and no one wants to pay 25 cents for that game anymore.
Right.
And they might even have it on their own device now. Mm-hmm. The consoles have gotten smaller, and so now there's all this space. It's number one, it's a good spot for you know, if you want to, like, unroll a sleeping bag and a mattress and kind of, like, hide out for a while in the wee hours of the night. That's a place. But also bicycle storage, like, that might be the solution for the Starlight route, to have actual roll-on service with hooks and whatnot instead of having to box it. So I don't have any, like, I don't have confirmation. Okay. It's a theory in my mind, but I like it. Mm-hmm. So
we
perhaps
took it, in March. And as of March, there was still Arkanoid, Galaga, Zaxxon, you know? I mean, every fabulous video game of 1985 was alive and well on Amtrak.
It sounds so cool, and yet when you see it, it's so disappointing. I think it sounds cool maybe because you and I grew up in the era when the arcade was a big thing. Do kids still go to arcades? What are the kids doing these days?
This is an area where I hesitate to go too deep, but I imagine that home video games are at a level now where why would you go pay 75 cents or a dollar or whatever?
Yeah.
Why would you?
Right.
You got, like, the craziest vector graphics and everything better, polygons and probably things that are 10 times cooler than that.
I'm still a big fan of Tempest, by the way. But
right, yeah.
So Aftermath, it's coming out very soon. Was it May 26th?
23rd.
I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. At the Clinton Street Theater here in Portland, Oregon. Mm-hmm. And tickets are available in advance.
So
you can get them now if you want them now. Mm-hmm. I haven't done that yet, but I plan to tonight. As soon as we're done here.
That is very nice.
But yeah, tell us about the film. We talked to you, was it about a year ago? I'm trying to remember. More than a year ago now. Yeah, it's been a while. But this was just in its infancy, I think, as far as, like, production and filming and shooting and whatnot. Now it's almost ready to come out. So what is the past unspecified amount of time been like?
So it was like a five-year project.
Yeah.
I mean, as in it was a five-year project. So it was October of 2009 to... Or no, October of 2008, rather, to... It was finished in April of 2013. And then you have this, you know, you have a festival circuit, and then you have your, it was called your theatrical release, which is what we're coming up on. So that, so the whole point of this was that I lived here in the 90s, you know, barely, not throughout the 90s, but I lived here in the 90s when an era where if you saw another bicyclist on the road, you would, like, shake them excitedly because it was such a rare occurrence. Mm-hmm. And then that sort of blew up in 5 years, and then again in five more years, and by even 2006 or 2007, people were sort of misquoting history, and so the people that were quoting history the most, you know, and had been around, had sort of had a stake in the game. They had a story to repeat for self-perpetuating purposes, you know. And whatever, more power to them. But there was a lot of the story that was being cut out. And that was what I was most invested in, was, you know. And I, you know, and it's hard, and whatever, this is like the whole, you don't want to come off being like, kids today, I don't understand them.
Get off my lawn.
But then on, you know, and I went through that period of my life where I was like, oh, cyclists used to be so much cooler and they all were my friends and they were all nice. And
that's probably, that could be true.
I mean, and but that's the wrong attitude, I guess, is the bottom line.
Yeah.
Like, true or not true, the fact that there's so many more of them is awesome. And it is the, it's like political will and it's our best interest in getting everything we want. And, you know, it's the greatest reason to go forward rather than, I feel like we were stuck politically for a good 5 years, which is my next point, that because the way history was being written, we hit a wall. You know, that there was sort of this false ideology that the only things that ever had been to our benefit were, you know, the BTA lawsuit in 1993, the bicycle bill in 1971, and people that we elected to public office to do their job.
Mm-hmm.
But that was, you know, that's obviously 10% of what happened and 10% of why it happened, you know?
Yeah.
And so that was sort of the story. And I, you know, again, this is in the get off my lawn department, I was very much like, oh, I totally know the story. And I will tell the people, you know, this was the same problem I ran into as a pompous teenager where I was like, I will tell everyone what happened and what's important. And then I learned so many things that blew my mind. And that was really, you know, that's the best reason to go into this.
Yeah.
It's like I didn't have, I mean, I had a thesis and it was proven wrong and I could not have been happier.
It's like a drummer hearing the metronome all of a sudden and being like, ah, we can change this.
Right. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I feel like, and it's funny because I feel like the impact of the film happened before the film came out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that it like fulfilled its own thesis and mission was to sort of correct these historical inaccuracies, which I am seeing now being corrected.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then the, in another level, you know, the story is mostly about Oregon's history, but it also has some international roots because, funny enough, the story is the same everywhere.
Right. Critical mass is an event that has happened in many cities all over the place, and so
right.
Apparently just not in Portland that often anymore.
Right. It's been a while, but that's fine. And that's, but, and I, this is what is most important to me, and I understand I've maybe done some disservices in this department, but the film is about more than critical mass,
mm-hmm.
you know, I mean, and that I think is where people get lost, you know, that it's really about the relationship between activism and advocacy and how they sort of lift each other out of the well in tandem rather than at odds with each other, which
yeah.
has sort of been the way the story has told, you know, and,
you've got activists on one side and advocates on the other, and they don't get along and they can't work together.
Right. And in every, maybe not quite every, in 90% of the people I interviewed, they would say more or less, the other side hurt the cause, no matter who they are. You know?
Right, right. No, that's actually a common thread, I feel like, yeah. So this will be interesting to see how this plays out then in the film.
Right. And so, you know, there's a lot of things. And so one sort of more... one of the weirder spoilers that I would want to give away is that, you know, I, and again, it's in the kids today, what are they up to? When I was, you know, I went into making this film to try and disprove my teenage self and my attitude about how I thought the world operated. And so I went into it thinking like, oh, everybody has a perspective and everybody, you know, has a relationship to each other and they've interacted in this interesting dynamic that created a social fabric across 40 years. So I'll believe everybody at their word. And then quickly, you know, and the bigger one here is, you know, people that have a really strong agenda, you know, and the police probably had the strongest agenda of anyone. And so, and I did interview the acting traffic captain of the precinct who was around during the heaviest years of critical mass, and
yeah.
And I believe is still not quite retired,
he's only half retired.
Yeah, and I mean, so now he's like a desk person, and you know, and
I guess that is half retired.
Right. Yeah, and does his interviews, and it was fascinating to show him like tangible evidence and for him to refute that over and over,
mm-hmm.
and you know, and to say that it was my bias and whatnot, and there was an another officer who I very much had a fabulous relationship with, Robert Pickett, who is now working federally, who I feel like went to extreme lengths to prevent the film from being all that it could be.
Interesting.
And would contact people that I had told him I was interviewing, and he would go to lengths to convince them not to talk to me. And that fascinated me, that it would be... And then, you know, and then I'm learning how to, you know, a lot of this was my own foray into processing and understanding paperwork. And to understand that, A, there is literally a spying department of the police bureau, and that, B, they targeted bicyclists in 1993, basically because one guy who was involved in something else they were interested in was a cyclist. They just followed him and then continued their surveillance. And that this really is what created tension for the next 13, 15 years, you know, that these memos and that just blew my mind, that A, the spy was illegal, and B, the whole thing was sort of justifying self-perpetuating, you know, there was no real incident to precipitate this.
Well, it's funny, because, like, in the climate and the culture that we live in now, like, it's almost assumed that you're being monitored and spied on at any point, and it's not quite as shocking. But it's interesting, it's almost a game of degrees in which, like, you're saying there's this one incident where the police followed one guy, and now we have the TSA scandal. I'm not saying the two are connected, but just saying, like, it's interesting how far the public perception of reasonable privacy has come since then. So, yeah.
Right. And you can read these very carefully written reports that will say, you know, I became aware of this meeting that happened and this conversation, and it never says, I was present at, you know, it doesn't say, the department came to possession of the information that.
Yeah, I heard there was a guy that did something.
They love passive verbs, and they hate adjectives.
Right.
And it's
like the opposite of my English teacher in college.
Right, exactly.
Use active voice.
And I guess, and it's like, on one hand, very disappointing to find out that my teenage self was really seemingly right about police officers and like the way law enforcement works. You know?
Yeah.
And that I really wanted to be like, you know, 20 years have gone by, you know, not who I was. And then to have that be just like, oh.
And some things don't change.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, and that's not, I mean, that's a small piece of the story. You know, obviously, there's much more that went on, and but there's a lot of stories that we just couldn't tell in, you know, like the story of how bikes ended up on TriMet is basically the same as, you know, the story of Critical Mass, where one gentleman who was sort of roughly pushed out of the Bicycle Transportation Alliance, it was his sort of pet project, and he would continually put his bike in front of the bus and hold up the bus, and he did this in such a manner, in, you know, in a way that built, you know, his... a platform for him to have these conversations. And then
this was in protest because he couldn't put his bike on the bus.
Right. It was at that time the modes were not designed to work together. And then there was an awkward sort of conversation where they're like, well, we need to train the public how to do it. That's the real problem.
Yes, because the city required you for, I don't remember how long it was. When I first moved to town, you had to go downtown to TriMet's offices and go through a training program and receive a card that would say, I know how to put my bike on a bus.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas today, any old schmo can do it.
Right. And in the very beginning, you know, and so in their negotiations, in the very beginning, you had to watch a 5-minute video, pay a $5 fee, get a little card, and you mean, and it's like common sense stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's stuff that we all would not need to be trained
like
to do.
Like applied mechanics.
Yes.
Have you seen that the hip hop promo video for how to put your bike on the TARC system in, I forget, is that Little Rock?
I believe it is Louisville.
Okay, Louisville.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I was very excited to find that my friend's stepdad was the director of that video.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty fabulous.
Yeah, right? And, but it, for me, you know, those kinds of things, like, we would never, you know, we have sort of this backwards relationship, especially as the cutting-edge city of North America, where, like, we fought that for years, you know? Like, such a basic thing. Like, you know, the bike and the bus are built to go together, like the bike and the Amtrak, you know?
Right.
Like, but at the same time, the city was very much, you know, it was a learning curve that I think the rest of the country benefited from. You know, this, you know, once we integrated, once we started doing experimental separated cycle tracks, once, you know, it allowed other people to sort of get on that team, you know. And I think that is the real learning lesson here, you know, that, and a lot of, I think part you know, critical mass has a bad reputation in Portland.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that is deserved, but I understand why.
Well, last time we talked, I think I was explaining how I had a very different perception of it than the picture that you painted of it, and I like your picture better because it's less less confrontational and more fun.
Right, and so this is the best part. So part of my, one of the best jobs of making this film was getting 1,000 pages of police incident reports and reviewing basically everything that ever happened. And I read all those documents, and a lot of them are really boring, but the one, you know, and I was present, not every time, obviously, because that would be impossible, but the, I believe I was witness to the worst incident, which really was a non-event, you know,
mm-hmm.
somebody was, their tires were smoking, and eventually one of their tires blew out. And they obviously claimed that somebody stabbed their tire until it exploded, and the people that were, you know, bicycling by at that time claimed that it was through their own behavior that their
right.
tire blew out.
Just a couple too many retreads on that tire.
Yeah, yeah. And then and I interviewed Michelle Poirot about it, who was, I believe, also president during that incident, and she said, and she had carefully thought about this, that she was like, I don't think you could puncture a tire. If you tried, and if
with
I know that if I tried to do it, I would hurt myself.
Right, right. Which it seems like this is a good, like, sort of like closed course, do not attempt sort of video that should be made someday.
Right.
Could a cyclist actually stab a tire open?
Right, right. Because yeah,
because there's a lot of wire in there.
Right. I mean, and that, and I, you know, and yes, I've made a trailer hitch out of a piece of car tire, and that was not on a moving car or anything. And that it took me, you know, really sharp. X-Acto blades,
mm-hmm.
and probably an hour of cutting,
right.
and to avoid anything that has aluminum in it, you know?
Right.
And that, you know, so yeah, I thought about it, and I'm like, oh. And that was literally the only incident of what could be quantified as an attack or
mm-hmm.
violence or, you know, and I talked to Joe Rose, the Oregonian reporter. And
yeah,
we
know Joseph Rose.
Yeah.
We don't know him personally.
What a guy.
We know a lot about him.
And so he, you know, he had frequently written about critical mass attacks, critical mass
right.
cause, incites violence, and so I was
not to mention the war on cars a couple of years ago.
It's a good one. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I got him on the phone, and I was like, "Do you have, you know, what are your sources on this?" And he, you know, he was very, very dodgy.
Well, everybody knows about it.
Right.
It's
yeah.
common knowledge.
Right. I'm a reporter, I'm a source, that is credible. And I said, okay, what did you witness? And he said, well, you know, on numerous occasions there was yelling.
I know a guy.
Right.
Yeah.
And he said, I witnessed people yelling on both sides back and forth. And I was like, would you qualify that as an attack? I mean, are like we so hippy-dippy in Portland?
Well,
yelling?
Compared to the ordinary passive-aggressiveness of the Northwest, that's pretty violent.
Right, it's like near death.
Yes. My ego was hurt.
Right, right. Somebody had to go home and write a blog post about it. Yes. Oh, it's true. But so, and then after that, I was like, wait a minute. If the guy that sort of wrote the history of this stuff never even saw anything beyond yelling, then I'm like, well, what did happen? And so I went through all those police reports. There's no violence. There's no,
mm-hmm.
you know, they're yelling at each other. And everybody,
some icy stares.
Yeah, everybody's heard a story, but it doesn't seem like any of it is based in more than folklore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if something did happen, why is it not in the police reports?
Right.
You know, like that's where that stuff is recorded. And those, I can tell you definitively, are way better than anybody's memory. Because everybody I talked to could like roughly approximate, and then the amalgamation of interviews would be quite similar to the police report,
mm-hmm.
but nobody, I mean, you know, it's been 20 years or whatever, you
yeah.
know, nobody could remember things right, you know, and that was interesting to, you know, I've never I've never had that kind of a project before where I'm like, what is the, you know, like, where is the kernel of truth?
What's the truth?
Yeah. And you know, especially from something so long ago where people have a stake in it.
So where is the film going to be?
Clinton Street Theater, May 23rd, 7 p.m.
Excellent.
And then we have a few for your out-of-state listeners. We have some coming up. We have San Diego, Los Angeles, Bay Area, New York City, and then we run Maine through Miami in June, a little bit into July.
Beautiful.
And you can find that at dinnerandbikes.com.
Oh, this is going to be paired with Dinner and Bikes.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome.
Yeah.
That sounds fabulous.
Thanks.
So, Johnny K., this that's for you. Well, thank you very much. If anyone's considering not seeing it, what would you say to them?
I would tell them that A, this will, as Ellie Blue says, this will make you rethink how you see your past and future in your role in bicycle advocacy as well as culture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's not just, and it's like, this is literally the story of what happened in Amsterdam also. You know, I mean, it's nearly identical. They obviously were much more successful. So if you want to build a bicycle paradise like Amsterdam, watch the film.
There we go. I can't think of a better answer than that. That's pretty good. Joe Beal, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Before I left, there was one more thing Joe wanted to sneak in.
So on May 23rd only, Emily Finch, bicycling, she does not want to be called Supermom, will be doing a Q&A along with a brand new film we made about her, The Greatest Gift.
That's right. I forgot about that. Yeah, I heard about that and I was very excited.
And so of all the people who are the most reluctant to be the spokesperson for anything and are continually dragged into talking for the movement.
Into the limelight.
Yes. And but she does. She's made tremendous inroads into that role, and I'm very excited that she wants to grace more inappropriate questions in person at the Clinton Street Theater.
Perfect. Again, Joe Beal, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So this will be a good time. I hope each and every one of you hearing this can make it to one event or to your own computer screen or television where you can see this film so you can check it out. We would love that. And now for the credits, we'll talk to you soon. You can email us at thesprocketpodcast@gmail.com. Hit us up on Twitter @sprocketpodcast. Phone in, leave your voicemail or SMS to 503-847-9774. And our website is thesprocketpodcast.com. Thanks to Ryan J. Lane for our music. And thank you to our sustaining donors for supporting our show costs. Logan Smith, Shadowfoot, Katharina Mellengard, Roger Grigsby, Wayne Norman, Doug Robertson, Ethan Jorgie, and Justin Martin. We appreciate that so much, and we will talk to you all in just a couple days with our next episode. Thank you very much. Sprocket Studios production.